It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to... I'm not sure. Is it Kubrick? Is it 2001? Is it Jaws? We have the Alfred Hitchcock review panel with us today, and that is, as always, my good friend, Mr. Sean Whalen.
It is a pleasure to be here as always, my friend.
It's a pleasure to be here with you. And then we have Blaine Dowler and Trey Hooks. Hey, boys.
Hello.
Hello.
And we have, I guess at Blaine's suggestion, I'm not going to even say request because I think we were all on board right away. We've expanded our Hitchcock coverage to... we will continue to do Hitchcock movies, but we're also going to be doing some Kubrick movies. And the Kubrick movies are starting from the beginning of his career, and we're doing them chronologically. We're not jumping around the way we are with Hitchcock. So today, we're taking a look at the beginning of Kubrick's career. And I'll tell you right off the... Well, you know what? We'll get to it in a moment. We're looking at the beginning of his career, which was three short films. Now, I think instead of talking about initially our experience with these films, I think we should probably just give our initial impressions as to Stanley Kubrick. And for me, it is definitely up and down. I first really experienced him where I was looking closely when I took my film class, my first film class in high school. So we're talking 1979. And I did my term paper for that class on A Clockwork Orange. So that was like the first real close look I looked at Kubrick. And then I became familiar with The Shining and Dr. Strangelove. And these are all high on my Kubrick list. But I have experienced some that are very low. I'm looking at you, Eyes Wide Shut. And some others there are on the list that I haven't had an opportunity to see, even though they've been on my to watch queue for a long time, like Spartacus. So I'm looking forward to getting to some of these, but I do not anticipate that everything I say is going to be a glowing review. I think we're going to have some healthy debate on some of these movies, and I'm kind of looking forward to getting to some of them. But for today, we're going to look at three short films that he started his career with, and we'll talk about those in a moment. Sean, what's your experience with Stanley Kubrick?
The Shining was my first experience with Stanley Kubrick. I'm a big Stephen King fan. I like, you know, his novels and things like that. And the film adaptations are certainly been unique with Stephen King. Let's set him off to the side now and talk about Kubrick. Dr. Strangelove was one that I saw in the theater when they did a re-release. They had a Cinematheque here that was doing a re-release of it. I got a chance to see that on the big screen. Loved it. Like you, I haven't seen everything of his. I've seen Eyes Wide Shut, and I think you're right. I think this is going to be a fun director to go through because I think that there's going to be some interesting conversations around his work as we go through it. And but the ones I'm rattling off to Dr. Strangelove and The Shining are two movies that I adore for very different reasons because they're very different films. But I think I'm actually really glad we're doing this because I think in the spirit of being able to debate and evaluate the work, I think these will be some entertaining conversations. That could be very different depending on our own interests. So I think this is going to be a fun one. But I have not watched this entire catalog. So I'm actually looking forward to doing it.
Lane or Trey?
Go ahead, Lane.
Oh, okay. So my first exposure to Stanley Kubrick was when I saw 2001 A Space Odyssey in film studies class. He has grown into one of my favorite directors. He's in the top three along with Hitchcock and Fritz Lang. But that said, I would say at his filmography, he's got three short films and 13 features under his belt. Three or four of them, I'm confident, will be Jaws 1 on these rewatches. Three or four of them, aside from the ones we're covering today, I'm confident will not be Jaws 1 ratings. Again, there is a range. I respect the meticulous filmmaking, but that doesn't mean every story works for me. So, yeah, that I tossed his name out because of that, and also because, as I said, it's a short enough filmography that going through all of it is reasonable. But there's some definite history in how it was put together. There's a few tangential ones I might throw out there too, because there's the 13 he directed. AI that was ultimately directed by Spielberg was started by Kubrick. So I think it would be interesting to see how that worked, because I think you can look at scenes where Spielberg was adhering strictly to Kubrick's notes, and then you could tell the scenes where Kubrick had no notes and Spielberg did his own thing, because there's quite the style clash in that film. So that basically that's what led us here. And as Paul said, we're doing these mostly chronologically. The one exception is that his first feature came out between the second and third short films. So he just pulled the short film in a few months earlier than it was actually released to do them all at once, because it just seemed to make sense.
Yes, I mean, I don't expect the short films. I don't think any one of these three short films would be enough to really satisfy a full episode of the show. So I think that was a wise choice by you. What do you say, Trey?
I think the first time I experienced Kubrick, I'll say it was part of 2001. My dad was a film fan, and the only bits I remember are the Hal scenes. So I don't know if I watched the whole movie and that's just what stood out to me as a kid, or if it was my dad bringing me in at that point because he thought I would enjoy it from that point on. The first Kubrick film, when I started selecting films myself, that I watched was A Clockwork Orange, so similar to Sean. I think what is so interesting about Kubrick is in a 50-year film career, broadly speaking, you could say he repeated genres a couple of times. You know, Lolita and Strange Glove are both comedies. You could say Clockwork Orange and 2001 are both science fiction films. But in terms of subgenres within those broader categories, he never repeated himself. You know, you have an epic in the 50s epic style. You have a gritty war film. You have a dystopian future. You have a more broad SF epic, a horror film, a film noir thriller. But he never goes back to the same well twice.
That's an interesting thought, and I hadn't really considered that. So, looking at his short films, we have three to take a look at today. There's Day of the Fight, The Flying Padre, and The Seafarers. And I'm going to read the entry from Wikipedia about his short films, which were between 1951 and 1953. Kubrick shared a love of film with his school friend Alexander Singer, who, after graduating from high school, had the intention of directing a film version of Homer's Iliad. Through Singer, who worked in the offices of the newsreel production company The March of Time, Kubrick learned it could cost $40,000 to make a proper short film, a sum he could not afford. He had $1,500 in savings and produced a few short documentaries, fueled by encouragement from Singer. He began learning all he could about filmmaking on his own, calling film suppliers, laboratories, and equipment rental houses. Kubrick decided to make a short film documentary about boxer Walter Cartier, whom he had photographed and written about for Look magazine a year earlier. He rented a camera and produced a 16-minute black-and-white documentary, Day of the Fight. Kubrick found the money independently to finance it. He had considered asking Montgomery Clift to narrate it, whom he had met during a photographic session for Look, but settled on CBS News veteran Douglas Edwards. According to Paul Duncan, the film was remarkably accomplished for a first film and used a backward tracking shot to film a scene in which Cartier and his brother walked towards the camera, a device which later became one of Kubrick's characteristic camera movements. Vincent Cartier, Walter's brother and manager, later reflected on his observation of Kubrick during filming. He said, "Stanley was very stoic, impassive, and but imaginative type person with strong imaginative thoughts. He commanded respect in a quiet, shy way. Whatever he wanted, you complied. He just captivated you. Anyone who worked with Stanley did just what Stanley wanted." After a score was added by Singer's friend Gerald Fried, Kubrick had spent $3,000 in making it and sold it to RKO Path for $4,000, which was the most the company had ever paid for a short film at the time. Kubrick described his first effort at filmmaking as having been valuable, since he believed to have been forced to do most of the work, and he later declared, "The best education in film is to make one." Inspired by this early success, Kubrick quit his job at Look and visited professional filmmakers in New York City, asking many detailed questions about the technical aspects of filmmaking. He stated that he was given the confidence during this period to become a filmmaker because of the number of bad films he had seen, remarking, "I don't know a goddamn thing about movies, but I know I can make a better film than that." He began making Flying Padre, a film which documents Reverend Fred Stadmuller, who travels some 4,000 miles to visit 11 churches. The film was originally going to be called Sky Pilot, a pun on the slang term for a priest. During the course of the film, the priest performs a burial service, confronts a boy bullying a girl, and makes an emergency flight to aid a sick mother and baby into an ambulance. Several of the views from and of the plane in Flying Padre are later echoed in 2001 A Space Odyssey, with the footage of the spacecraft and a series of close-ups on the faces of people attending the funeral were most likely inspired by Sergei Eisenstein's Battleship Potemkin and Ivan the Terrible. Flying Padre was followed by The Seafarers, Kubrick's first color film, which was shot for the Seafarers International Union in June of 1953. It depicted the logistics of a democratic union and focused more on the amenities of seafaring other than the act. For the cafeteria scene in the film, Kubrick chose a dolly shot to establish the life of the seafarers' community. This kind of shot would later become a signature technique. The sequence of Paul Hall, Secretary Treasurer of the SIU Atlantic and Gulf District, speaking to members of the union, echoes scenes from Eisenstein's Strike and October. Day of the Fight, Flying Padre, and The Seafarers constitute Kubrick's only surviving documentary works. Some historians believe he made others. So, I watched all three of these documentaries on YouTube. That was how I got access to them. I found them all to be, in my opinion, kind of standard documentary fare of the day. They felt like something I would see in an old newsreel from the movies. I didn't see really the elements of, oh, I could see this guy's going to become, you know, a renowned filmmaker as I watched it. Now, there are shots that are referred to in this Wikipedia section where they say, you know, he was aping Eisenstein. He was using something that would later become one of his signature moves. they didn't jump out at me at the time, to be totally fair. I thought they were very well put together, frankly. I thought that there was kind of a narrative flow to the respective documentaries, but I didn't see anything that made me say, you know, you got to get this guy, you know, a script to make a feature film. So I'm curious what everybody's first impressions were of these three, and then we could go into some details.
I agree with you on Flying Padre in particular. That very much had, and maybe it's down to the style of narration, but that very much had that time marches on kind of newsreel feel to it. I think the one I might view more favorably than you, Paul, is Day of the Fight. I felt like that was less, it had the feeling of being less staged and more more natural, like comparing it to the Flying Padre, like that all felt like staged reenactments of something that may or may not have happened. Like, I don't know that's how the Padre would have necessarily really handled the bullying, that like the bully's just right out the door that you can walk to and confront. But like, I didn't feel like that wasn't how Walter Cartier prepared for a fight. I felt like, I felt like the scripted narration was much more compelling. You got more into a sense of what was going on in Walter's mind, and it had, as we'll get into, cover things like the killers. It had a really kind of cinema verite feel to it. It's seeing that, it's no surprise to me that his first couple of feature length films were more in that film noir style, if you will.
I liked Day of the Fight in particular for the fact that it focused on the challenges of being a boxer, just how many people were trying to be a boxer, and the fact that, you know, it doesn't matter how good you are, it's in those scenarios you've got such competition out there, and out of, you know, the hundreds of them, this very, very small group would be ones that could even make a living doing it. The Monday Night Fights, the idea of this, you know, trying to maintain this pace and trying to get yourself to that point where you have those fights that are propelling you to the title picture, for, you know, potentially more money, but also for the glory. They're all striving for that type of opportunity, depending on weight class they were in. That part I thought was really great. And when they were doing the behind the scenes stuff, I'm a big fan of boxing films, but I also am a pretty decent casual fan of boxing itself. If I love to watch a good fight, it doesn't matter if what weight class they are. And if I know that, it doesn't matter if they're big names to me or not. If it's a good fight, I really enjoy watching it. And in the case of this, I liked how it was showcasing the preparation behind the scenes with him and his brother. I thought it was really cool and well-paced. Mm-hmm. Nothing overstayed its welcome in that one, which I think is, it's hard to do that in a documentary sometimes. And I thought the pacing of Day of the Fight was really strong, because we got like a chronological build from, you know, the overview of what it means to be a boxer straight on through to the intimacy of getting to the fight itself. And the fight, I thought he was trying some interesting things with camera perspective. When we got under the two boxers and there was the fighting going on, that stood out for me. I was like, well, that's kind of cool. You know, obviously we're dealing with something it's an older documentary, but, I watched it. I got the Blu-ray of, Fear and Desire to get all three of these. And, I thought that was there were some neat attempts for a documentary, because documentaries, kind of your expectation is they're going to be sometimes a little bit more dry, because they're not trying the typical exciting film tricks off of that end. I thought with Day of the Fight, he did a good job with that. I'll talk a little bit. I don't want to dominate the whole time here, but I do want to talk more about Flying Padre too.
But I love that same shot, Sean, what impressed me by it is if you kind of look at their torsos, I get the feeling that like they weren't just standing still swinging at each other. So how he got the camera down there on the canvas, but they didn't manage to step on someone, I don't know. And I think any other documentary from the time would have filmed the whole fight from 10 feet away.
That stood out for me. I thought it made the fight more exciting when I'm used to fights usually from boxing films where they're clearly trying to get you the right shots to make that kind of thrilling sequence and cutting out what doesn't fit. I thought he did a good job with that. It did. The fight was exciting.
I find it interesting that you guys both pulled out Days of the Fight of the Standout because that was the one passion project here. Flying Project and Seafarers were both works for hire, so he could bank the money, because for most of his career, he was filming with cameras he owned. He wasn't renting, the studio didn't have them. He was very precise with his camera equipment. So he would actually own the cameras that he was filming with. And that's part of the reason, as Paul said, when he was reading from Wikipedia, there's conjecture and speculation that there's more documentary films out there by him, because we didn't realize the Seafarers was part of his filmography until about the 80s. Somebody literally found it in a film can, put it in, and recognized the director credit. It had been kind of lost. When they went to the estate saying, is this really you? He's like, well, yeah, it was. And he wasn't super proud of his early career. We'll definitely be talking about that with Fear and Desire. He tried to destroy every known copy of that one. But Day of the Fight was the passion project.
It's interesting to see his early starts just from a historical perspective, as opposed to sitting and watching the movies and, you know, being entertained by them. I know people who are, you know, who are desirous to be in the film industry. I know people who are actually in the industry to whatever extent. And there definitely has to be a level of passion, because it's one of these careers where if you make it big, you know, you can make big bucks, but there's a lot more people that are toiling and in competition with others for very, very low money, because it is such a desirable job to do. You know, it's one of the few jobs that the people I know who have it say, I love going to work every day. There's not that many people who can legitimately say that. So you can understand where somebody might be driven. And you hear stories of, you know, what you heard about Kubrick, you know, you hear stories about that, like with Kevin Smith or Quentin Tarantino or other people who, you know, fight to get the money to make some kind of a feature or whatever. And it's interesting, again, to see the progression. I do agree with you guys that Day of the Fight is the more interesting of the three. And part of it is the fact that it feels more natural. As I watched The Flying Padre, I did have that feeling that they were restaging a lot of things and that they were a little bit more stiff and not really the way it actually happened. You know, they may be true factually, but they didn't feel like they were occurring as you're watching them. They felt like a recreation, you know, especially like when he meets with the bully who's bullying the girl, and then they walk off with his arm around her. And it, I think the narrator even says, and that didn't last long or something like that. So it's kind of interesting from that perspective. Go ahead, Trey.
I think the problem with The Flying Padre is the fact that they chose a little snippet with kids. The girl in particular clearly doesn't know where she's supposed to be looking. So it's that, because, you know, it's that weird thing where it's, I'm trying not to look at the camera, but because I can't look at the camera, I don't know where to look. So she's kind of, when she's supposed to be interacting with the priest, she's kind of staring somewhere in between the camera and him, if you follow what I mean.
I definitely do, and I'll talk about that in a second.
And that just, that adds to the whole artifice and the restaging feel of it.
I in college took a filmmaking class. And one of my best friends also took the class, and the final project was you had to make your own movie. And I had a part in his and he had a part in mine. And when I look at his, I think I might be the worst actor ever in the world, because I was grinning when I shouldn't be. I looked at the camera periodically. It was terrible. It was absolutely terrible. And it gave me the ability to look at bad acting performances and kind of pick them out a little bit, having that as a yardstick to measure it against. And I did see some of what you're talking about with this young girl, and she had the excuse of being, she was a very young girl. I was a college student at the time. I should have known better.
Flying Padre was interesting for me. I actually found it real endearing. And I guess I walked into that one. I want to say least interested, but I knew Day of the Fight, I knew I was going to be interested, and I wanted to, you know, see the whole boxing thing. But Flying Padre, I think where it hit me, and I might be unique on this one out of our group, but there were like a little bit of Rocketeer vibes and a little bit of Flash Gordon vibes when he was like flying in. Yes, they definitely felt like they were stage setups, but I really appreciated when he was going to rescue the girl. And the child who is sick, and you know, he's rushing out there. We got to see his entire process for getting that plane started from multiple camera angles. The door was left open to the plane a much longer time than probably is safe for a normal takeoff, for the purpose of showing us the controls, showing us his process, what was going on, and nothing was a single shot of that. So I thought that the camera dynamic, as far as seeing like just how much goes into this priest, you know, flying from place to place, I thought was kind of cool. It separated and made him kind of interesting. That was one where, I talked about pace with Day of the Fight. Flying Padre had the danger of being something that if you spent too long with it, it's going to lose something. I thought it was shorter. I think it needed to be shorter, but I think that was the right, I think that made it intriguing. I enjoyed learning about him. I found some of it interesting. I liked when he came in, that like this idea that I could see if I was local there, I don't know, I might go hang out and see his sermons a little bit. The guy would be intriguing. So I thought that they did a good job of making this whole excitement. Yes, definitely that one, it was staged. But I thought the kid thing was when, like, you know, you knew that like that arm was going away pretty quickly. That's kids. And I loved that felt like it was an authentic recreation of what happened with the two of them versus this idea. And they went off and they were best buddies afterwards. That isn't his role. His role was presented in a very realistic way that I thought was really well done. As far as that piece goes, I was surprised at how much I enjoyed that one, because I walked in being kind of like, I'm going to watch it because we're doing this. And I actually quite liked like his whole premise, not knowing where that was going to go.
I do think the shot where he's coming into land and there's the two guys with the horses to immediately take him off, like, that could be the opening to like a 50s action adventure show, right? Because he lands and the plane barely stops and he hops out running for the horses, right? I do feel like Kubrick took it up to as far as he could with the pacing, with the flying shots. Blaine, you'll remember this. When we covered Out of Africa, one of our negatives was there were a lot of swooping aerial shots that were supposed to be beautiful, and they were, and they went on about a minute too long every time. Kubrick takes this up to the point, but he never passed that point where you're like, okay, I feel like I'm just seeing the same shots of the planes.
Yeah, Out of Africa often felt more like a tourism adding or advertisement than storytelling. Whereas here, Kubrick is storytelling. Mm-hmm. I will say, as far as the storytelling is concerned, the Seafarers in particular, I would single out as the blandest finished product in Kubrick's entire catalog, which could be why we haven't really brought it up in this discussion. But what I find most interesting about these is knowing this is what he's doing out of the gate. And the camera work is not exactly pedestrian. I mean, some of them are, but every Flying Padre and Day of the Fight both have a couple of shots where you could tell he is trying to make it dynamic. He's going for the dynamism. Flying Quadrate, yes, he was definitely restaging and recreating actual events. So he'd spoken to the people who were, you know, in the parishes, said, what are your strong memories about this padre, you know, and things that he had done. They reproduce those and recreate them. Just part of the criticism he got, because at the time there was already a trend for the cinema verite. Even though the first documentary ever, that Nanook of the North, didn't really have cinema verite, at least traditional documentary. The first, what, 5-7 years of film were little more than animated postcards. So you could argue that they're all very short documentaries because they're not trying to stage anything. But yeah, I found a lot of the same. You had some interesting shots. He had some interesting camera work, especially for someone who was just out of the gate. There were really no camera angles that failed in this one. He got the job done. But yeah, the flying Padre and the Seafarers. Seafarers is the worst for it, where those were the jobs for hire.
Yeah, Day
of the Fight had the passion project.
I did find that the Seafarers felt very by the numbers in comparison to the other two. And I attributed it to exactly what you're saying, that it was, you know, a job for hire. I was left with the impression that they specified to him what they wanted, and he gave them what they wanted. So it has a little less of the creativity and a little less of the passion involved in it. I think, you know, Day of the Fight, as you've mentioned, is clearly his passion project. And you could see where that would inspire you. You know, you just really, you know, put yourself in a financial bind to try and make this movie, to make your filmmaking bones and get yourself a reputation. So you're really just, you know, focusing on everything about it that you really want to do. The Flying Padre, while, you know, we've criticized some of the recreations, it is a subject matter that at least you could, I think, sink your teeth into. The Seafarers is a propaganda film by the Union. And, you know, it's done for hire. And again, I think they told him, this is what we want. And he gave them what they wanted. I don't think it allowed for as much creativity because of that.
I agree, Paul. All of these are flattering to their subject, but I think an argument could be made that The Seafarers is not a 30-minute documentary. It's a 30-minute commercial.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you look at the camera work in The Seafarers, it's not as dynamic as it is in the other two.
Yeah.
So it really feels to me the most like he's saying, okay, I've got a job to do. What's the cheapest way to get the job done well? So I could put the most or the, you know, maximum amount of my paycheck in the bank to fund something better and something more interesting.
It is the one where there wasn't a particular shot that I was thinking about after, like, you know, we mentioned the below the fighter shot in Day of the Fight. For the Flying Padre, for me, it was the pullback shot of the priest by his plane that impressed me. There really wasn't one in The Seafarers. There was nothing bad in it, but there was nothing where I went, ah, I see Kubrick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, like I said, The Seafarers is trying to be informative. I remember the boring short films we saw for educational purposes on the 8mm clacking projector in class. It's more entertaining than some of those. But Calendar definitely would not have been in one of the ones I saw in school, but you know, it made it into here, which also is a nice tip of the hat saying, women may not enjoy working here. It's very much an all-boys club. So, yeah, The Seafarers, it gets the job done, but that's it. It really is, like Paul said, it's like they said, they handed him a checklist of things to include, and he just went, check, 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 done, here you go.
I kept expecting to see the coronet at the beginning because it was the educational short type of thing. The only thing I would say with The Seafarers, and there's nothing you could do with it. You had to get everything in. I did feel like that one for me felt like a trudge by the end. I felt like it was just long. But it was meant to give you a comprehensive information as far as all the perks of being a seafarer, and did that well. So I'm saying that I'm contradicting myself in saying that it did it well, but it definitely not having an interest in becoming a seafarer. I felt like I learned a lot as far as all their perks, but that was out of the three of them, that was the one I was I think least interested in as I was watching it. I was interested in seeing it at first.
I'm going to start off by saying I think this was worthwhile to watch these from a historical filmmaking point of view. But again, I wasn't like particularly entertained by any of them, but I was fascinated more than entertained. But it definitely created a flashback to, you know, sitting in one of those one seat desks and having the teacher roll in a TV on wheels so that you could watch these films. They had that dry feeling about them to me. So that was interesting. But I think, again, from a historical point of view, to see somebody who is renowned as one of the, you know, all-time filmmakers, and this is where he started, and this is how he put things together, I think it's definitely worthwhile viewing. And again, yeah, it's under an hour to watch all three, and they're all available on YouTube.
And I think what you're describing is the way to watch it. When you're sitting here decades after they were made, seeing what Kubrick had become,
yes,
going back to look at how he mm-hmm. started. I think if I were in theaters in 1951 watching these, I wouldn't walk out going, this is a director I'm going to keep my eye on.
Exactly. I agree mm-hmm. totally. It's interesting to know, you know, Kubrick's reputation of being, you know, basically, like, he makes Alfred Hitchcock look meek from everything I understand. And, you know, the stories of him basically torturing Shelley Duvall are legendary. So it's going to be interesting as we go over these movies to see. But keeping that in mind and just trying to imagine what was going through him, through his brain as he was making these movies, knowing how passionate he could be about just trying to get exactly the shot he wanted, I think just adds another level of fascination to watching these.
Yeah, and I really think if you want to get a lot out of them, that's the approach you have to take. Mm-hmm. I would say if you haven't seen Kubrick films before, this may not be a great starting place because you don't see what it's building to.
Yeah.
If you start here, it's not really going to stand out that much. Right. If you are familiar with the other documentaries of the 50s, right, the ones that Walt Disney kept getting Oscar nominations for. I mean, Walt Disney was the most nominated man in Academy Award history. And most people assume it's for the animated work, but his documentary nominations actually outnumber the animation slightly because mm-hmm. he was producing so many of these.
He's the head of documentaries.
Yep. Yeah. So if you go through and look at it, well, you know what? Even then, I would actually say that he wasn't the Edith Head, because Edith Head was directly involved in everything. Some of those, Disney was just, yeah, worthwhile, here's a check. And he was very hands-off in how the documentaries were actually made, because his passion was the animation. So he'd be there when they were breaking the story for the animated shorts much more often than he was there when they were breaking down for the documentaries. He would just say, oh, nature documentaries are big. I don't know any about this animal or this animal. Go find someone. And here's their check. And bring it back when it's done, kind of stuff. He was a lot more hands-off with those. But he knew who to hire to do it well. He gave them budgets needed to do it well. And he kept getting the Oscar nominations. So in terms of direct involvement, I would say that the front runners for most nominations for that would be Edith Head and John Williams. Mm. But the Academy Award stuff is better suited for the show Trey and I do. So,
I think also if you're watching this from a historical perspective, probably the most interesting one, not only on a subject matter level, but on a viewing level, is probably Day of the Fight, because Kubrick had his hands on everything in that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There was no aspect of it that he wasn't taking total control of. Whereas in the other ones, especially in The Seafarers, I'm sure he handed off some of the the duties to others to take care of.
Yeah, Seafarers, it felt almost like the Union wrote the script.
Yes.
And he just put it on screen.
Yep,
absolutely. I think, you know, as we talked about before we started recording, I think we have a relatively short episode here, but I think we've had some interesting talk. But before I call it to a close, anything, any specific notes anybody has, anything about the themes, the filmmaking aspect, or anything of any of these three?
Yeah, not for these three, on my end. As we said, I mean, Kubrick is one of my favorite directors. We will definitely get into that by the time it's done. I think we should toss out, let people know what the titles are we're going to eventually cover. We could kind of talk about the plan for this before we're done. Since it's a shorter episode, we can give them a look ahead.
Okay, and we'll get to that in a moment. I think what we should do is we should not rate these on the Jaws scale, because I don't think that's a fair rating for these particular movies. I think the thing to do is just kind of put them in order of quality or interest or entertainment value. And in that regard, I think we had diminishing returns, because I think his first one was the most interesting. And then the Flying Padre is close, but not quite there. And the Seafarers is the least interesting of the three.
I would agree with you. My viewing experience was I wasn't sure which one was first. So I watched Flying Padre, Day of the Fight, and then The Seafarers. So while from an entertainment perspective, your order, I agree with, if I didn't know better the way I watched it, I would think that like Flying Padre was his very first effort and he's learning on it. Day of the Fight, oh wow, he's really learned something. Seafarers, now he's mastered it, but he's got material far below his talent. What was kind of what my experience was viewing it. But in terms of that most entertaining to least entertaining, I agree with your ranking. I think it's Day of the Fight, Flying Padre, and then the Seafarers.
I watched Seafarers first, then I went to Day of the Fight and Flying Padre, and let me do the 30-minute one first. I tend to watch a lot of these things on my treadmill when I'm doing that, and so I'm like, let me start off with the 30-minute one and kind of make my way through it. I might be slightly different than you guys as far as which one I thought was the most entertaining. I really enjoyed Flying Padre. I felt like the subject matter was real interesting. I do think technically, out of the two of them, I think Day of the Fight's incredibly interesting too. I really enjoyed that one. But I think that one is more technically sound as far as him doing more tricks. But I thought there were things that he was doing in Flying Padre that were really intriguing me, particularly around the plane and takeoffs and building this sense of it's hard when you're doing a documentary version of an event to recreate this sense of urgency to his, I'm going to get to this woman because nobody else can. And the way that he turned the whole starting up the plane into this whole dramatic sequence, I thought was kind of cool. He's seeing some early stages of a filmmaker who's trying to take subject matter and make it intriguing with what he's working with. I was interested in the Flying Padre. Like I said, I was linking it to like Flash Gordon and Rocketeer. I'm not saying it's exactly like those things. Don't get me wrong. I'm not out of my mind. But there were elements of that that got me intrigued by what he was doing. So I'd maybe give a slight edge to Flying Padre for me. Love Day of the Fight because I'm a boxing fan, and Seafarers, I made my way don't get me wrong, it's interesting subject matter to see once. I don't need to see Seafarers again. That was my ranking of the three.
Yeah, I would actually rank them as Sean did, where I found Flying Padre a little more engaging than Day of the Fight. And someone that, you know, those who've listened to 99 Years, 100 Films and our coverage of Rocky and stuff, I'm just not a huge fan of boxing as a sport or boxing films in general. So that, you know, in terms of that, for me as a viewer, sort of Day of the Fight had that extra hurdle to get over. But if we were ranking these on the Jaws scale, I think we could agree that Day of the Fight and Flying Padre are far more likely to end up in the same category or the same ranking than Seafarers.
Yeah.
I think we could all agree they would be in distinct. Seafarers would not be in the same categories either, the other two. But the other two maybe.
Well, and that's why I'm glad that...
I'm sorry. I'm going to take personal umbrage to the fact that you're denigrating the Rocky film, since it's one of the few episodes of 99 films that I was on.
But... and if you recall in that one, I say, like, that is the exception, because that first Rocky film is, so far, the boxing film I really enjoy. And it's the one I will enjoy going back to.
Fair enough. Considering I'll accept that as an apology.
Yeah, and considering that that Kubrick has another boxing film coming up, so Killer's Kiss also has a strong boxing element to it.
We will get there. Trey, I'm sorry, I interrupted. You were going to say something?
No, I was just going to say, I'm glad you suggested that we give a ranking differently, because I do think, just because of the rules of the jaw scale, these would have been unfairly maligned.
Yes.
Yeah, and I don't think you watch these to see potentially Academy Award performances or anything like that. This is to see the development of a filmmaker. That's the purpose that mm-hmm. this was. And we're going to continue with this as well as our Hitchcock retrospective. And for that, I'm going to hand off to Blaine to say, you know, where we're going to go and what we're going to do, because we follow his lead on these.
Okay, so what I've got laid out for Kubrick, from here we're going to do his filmography in sequence of release, which from this point forward is also the order they were made, because they're usually a few years apart, which means the next subject will be Fear and Desire, which is the one that he tried to have destroyed because he felt it was like a child's crayon scratchings on his mother's fridge. It was very early in his career. It's interesting because you can see he's swinging for the fences, but he hits a lot of foul balls when he's doing it in that one. And then a few extras
now,
that are in.
I'm sorry. I think for now I was thinking that maybe we're going to go back and forth. Kubrick, Hitchcock, and just kind of do it that way, unless you guys have any other thoughts on that. Okay.
The way I had it laid out, we're going to be doing a few Hitchcocks in between each Kubrick, because Hitchcock's filmography is so much larger.
So okay. We follow your lead. You set the pace, and we'll follow it. What are we doing next then?
So next we have Young and Innocent by Hitchcock as the first of three Hitchcock films we'll do before we come back to Kubrick. At the end of Kubrick's filmography, so after Eyes Wide Shut, I also have laid in there Stanley Kubrick, A Life in Pictures, which is a documentary made for the box set of his work. Then AI, Artificial Intelligence. I also slipped in Minority Report, because I think Spielberg may have looked at AI and said, yeah, that didn't really work, and went back to do a different tribute to Kubrick that did. And I think that's where Minority Report came from. And in there, I also have at the end Keller Me Kubrick, which is a film about a real life con artist who had half of LA convinced he was Stanley Kubrick, even though there were no physical similarities or personality similarities in any way, shape, or form. And the con man did not appear to have even watched any of Kubrick's films. So that's and that stars John Malkovich. So, nope. That's a film with John Malkovich, which
I had never heard of that.
So the idea is,
I'm interested in it.
Yeah, and the idea is, I haven't scheduled in there because I wanted to talk to you guys first. There are two sequels to Kubrick films that Kubrick was not involved in. So if we're interested in covering 2010 and Dr. Sleep, let me know, and I will throw those in the schedule as well.
I think I would be interested, and those are sequels to two films that I think will be very engaged by. So it's going to be interesting in that I have both of those in my, these are movies I've wanted to see list, but I've never seen either of them yet. So I think I'd like to add them on. Mm-hmm. But you mentioned that we're going to do three Hitchcocks. You said Young and Innocent, and then what are the other two?
The Birds and Under Capricorn in three separate episodes. But
yes. Well, I'm just thinking it's not a bad thing to throw this out so that if there's any listeners who'd like to get a kind of a head start on things. I mean, the way we do these episodes, we're talking a great deal of time before we get to the next Kubrick movie, but we will get there. And, you know, the one of the three Hitchcock movies I can give the most, you know, experience with is The Birds. And I'm going to just throw it out there for a moment that I somehow saw that when I was extremely young. And I can't imagine, you know, how it was on TV even at that point, because I am older than the birds. But I remember, you know, I had nightmares as a very, very young child of birds attacking me like Tippi Hedren was attacked. So that one's going to be very interesting to take another look at, although I've seen it numerous times, but it's going to be interesting to dissect. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Young and Innocent is next. So
I did a quick look. Paul, at least in the States, I don't know if it's different in Canada, The Young and the Innocent is available on Tubi now. So for any listeners who want to watch along and not invest money in renting it, at least right now, you can watch it for free on Tubi.
Good to know, actually.
Yeah, I'll check the Canadian listings and Just Watch as well.
Cool. All right. In the meanwhile, thanks, guys, for coming on and doing this. I hope our listeners were entertained by this. I guess I would call this an introduction to Stanley Kubrick. or is it 2001 yet? But we're going to, you know,
okay, and just to follow up on that.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So for Canadian viewers, it is not on Tubi, but it is listed on Plex, according to Just Watch. And I think it might be one of his last British films. And if it's the British films, the entire catalog is actually public domain now. So it won't be hard to track down.
I'm just looking. It's a 1937 film and seems to be pretty available. So cool deal. Again, yeah, thank you guys for
one of the British ones, because his first American film was Rebecca, and that was 1940.
All right, so I look forward to seeing another Hitchcock movie that I had never seen before. Mm-hmm. In the meanwhile, thanks everybody for listening, and we'll catch you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.
What did you get from Kubrick?
Well, I wish I could tell you succinctly what I get. I get a lot of things, but I don't know that I can reduce them down to I'm going to now change this way of working or that way of working. The essential thing about Kubrick is his absolute obsession with every single detail, no matter how small and how detailed it is. And it was his inability to ever say he was finished until he got precisely and exactly what he wanted. Hence the famous number of takes that he does, which is not a myth, I found out. You know, it's very common to be on take 75 or take 80. I don't think I've ever gone past the 20s in my life, and if I go to 20, it's a tragedy to me. That, you know, I mean, if I do five takes or six takes, I start to get nervous already on a picture. But 70 takes, 80 takes, 100 takes was absolutely regular with Stanley.
I imagine you obviously would respect him, but was it exasperating?
Was it what?
Exasperating.
Well, yes, it is. It was for me. I mean, it was both interesting as hell and exasperating as hell. I mean, I finally said, it's not going to get any better, Stanley. It's just not. I'm not a professional actor. It's not. I didn't, to be honest with you, I didn't personally have to do that many takes, because he knew he wasn't going to get any more. But I had to be in the scene when Tom was doing them. I mean, there were two shots, so it'd be over my shoulder or whatever. So I had to do it that many times. And with Tom, we regularly went to take above 70 and 80 takes all the time. Mm-hmm.
Do you think he's the man with the genius? Kubrick.
Yes, I think Kubrick was a man of genius, of real genius. Yes. I don't think everybody in the world likes all of his movies, like anybody else, but he made very few movies, and they were extraordinary. And I mean that not good, not bad. I mean they were extraordinary. They are not like anyone else's movies. They're not exactly real. They're surreal in a way that not very many directors know how to do. And I don't think Stanley did it on purpose. I think Stanley couldn't help doing it that way. He once said to, I believe it was Matthew Modine on Full Metal Jacket, after a certain take, and Matthew said, "Ooh, that felt good, that felt real." And Stanley said, "Real is good, interesting is better." And that's the way he worked. I mean, there's nothing real about any of those movies that he made, but they're hypnotic. To me, they are, anyway. There's a kind of focus and concentration in every frame of a Kubrick film that I think grabs you in a certain way. You may not even like it. I can't say that I liked Clockwork Orange. I was uncomfortable the whole time I was watching it, but it was hypnotic, terrifically hypnotic.